I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey folks, thanks for joining us on our podcast. We're glad you're here. We're back at it again with another episode on the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. And I feel like we've really been on a great roll with some really good topics and really great guests. Rob, it's always fun to jump on here and record. How do you feel about our lineup that we've had here recently?
Yeah, hey, Brittany, you know, I totally agree. We've had some great guests on recently and covered some interesting topics that I know that I was curious about. And I'm sure that our listeners were curious about too. So if you're tuning in for the first time or you missed an episode or two, be sure to hop back in time. That's kind of the beauty of podcasts, right? You can just go back to those missing episodes and get caught up, all those topics and guests. You know, I don't know if you're like me, Brittany, but I've got certain podcasts that I listen to pretty well weekly. And then I've got other ones that I like hoard. And then when we go on a road trip, I save them up, you know, and I can listen to those when we're going down the road. So anyway,
I feel like I'm either very caught up or I'm approximately 1 year behind on some of my episodes. And that's okay. That's the beauty of technology and be able to access all of this. Well, speaking of podcast guests, I'm excited to hear from today's guest and learn about what the Hawkeye State has going on too when it comes to the Great Plains outdoors. Today's guest is Jamie Cook from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Jamie serves as the Hunter Education Coordinator for the department, and his primary responsibilities are to oversee coordination of hunter, bow hunter, and fur harvester education programs. He is also responsible for the coordination of the advanced hunter education programs that includes various clinics, workshops, camps, and mentored hunt opportunities, such as Field to Fork, Learn to Hunt, Learn to Trap, and Learn to Shoot offerings. Prior to his role, Jamie served in partnership in between the Iowa DNR and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever as a state coordinator of conservation delivery for Iowa. That's a big job. Before he served as a conservation educator for 10 years for the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources. 5 of those years were in the Hunter Education Program, where he served as the state's R3 and mentor hunt coordinator. Jamie earned his bachelor's degree in wildlife management, as well as a master's degree in recreation and park administration, both from Eastern Kentucky University. Jamie currently lives in Winterset, Iowa, with his wife, Anna, and 3 daughters, Lydia, Cora, and Caroline. And don't forget about his black lab pup, Millie. Jamie, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brittany. Thanks, Rob. Excited to be here.
It's fun to hear all about your background. It's like one of my favorite parts is introducing our guests and getting a recap about where they've been and what they've done. And by gosh, you've done a lot, Jamie.
It's a story, let me tell you. It's a story, that's for sure. It's been a cool thing to be part of 3 different organizations that have to do with conservation in such a short amount of time.
Yeah,
so it certainly learned a lot.
You kind of cut your teeth in the outdoor industry by being an R3 coordinator.
I did, yep. Early on, I was a naturalist for about 5 years over in Kentucky and had a fun time there working with kids and talking to them about different wildlife and, you know, handling birds of prey and doing that fun public showy things. I made up a word, showy things. It was fun there, and then had a chance to come on board and join the Hunter Ed team there in Kentucky. And yeah, before I left, I ended up the R3 coordinator there for Kentucky Fish and Wildlife.
All very important roles, which I really, really love to hear that in your description. Like, I mean, there's not one of those roles that a state agency can get by without having. Thanks for all of your hard work and all that, because I know they're sometimes thankless jobs and they're hard jobs, but they're well worth it. So thanks for doing all of that.
Oh, no problem at all. And thanks again for having me today. This is going to be, it's going to be fun.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking with some other folks about, you know, where else we can kind of dive in on the Great Plains and interview some folks from, and Iowa came on the docket, and I said, I've got the perfect guy. So let's talk about hunting in Iowa. You know, big game, upland migratory birds. You know, let's just dive into it. What do you love?
Oh, well, okay. So kind of going back historically in the Cook annals of history, I started as a, so, you know, going back to the idea of R3 and trying to recruit adults, especially, you know, that have not hunted. I had hunted a little bit in college, and it was mostly my dad taking me out and saying, go sit in that tree stand and shoot something when it comes by. There was no scouting. There was no teaching. There was just go sit and shoot. And so needless to say, I didn't harvest anything those years in college. We didn't grow up hunting. He got into it after I'd grown and, you know, started college. But later in life and getting this job actually in hunter education, they were like, you probably should start hunting. And I said, I just need somebody to take me. And so before I left there, I was just in love with Kentucky's rifle season. It in Kentucky, it synced up really well with the rut. And, you know, for whatever side of the fence you stand on, whether you're a rifle hunter or a bow hunter, it's just a magical time to be out in the woods, period. And I consider myself a deer hunter, I guess, when I moved out here. But coming out to the plains or the prairie, whatever you want to call Iowa, I would probably have to say more prairie, but
land of the corn.
Yeah, well, that's pigs too. Coming out to Iowa, I'd not pheasant hunted, and I came out into this partnership role with the DNR and pheasants and quail forever, and I hadn't pheasant hunted ever. And one of the first things I got to do was go out and hunt these birds. And I'm telling you, I had easily gotten addicted to that because you could show up at the parking lot at 8 o'clock. Season was over at 4:30 or day, you know, your day hunts were over at 4:30. You could get back home. I mean, that's business hours, right? Like I could just tell my wife, hey, I'm going to go to work today and actually just go hunt if I wanted to. And it fit my family schedules perfectly. So I really just fell in love with pheasant hunting. And so last year made the jump into being a dog owner, and we went with a lab just because they're so versatile and able to retrieve lots of different things.
You're speaking Rob's love language.
Oh yeah,
for sure. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So yeah. I want to back up just a little bit, if you don't mind. How did you go from a guy that really didn't hunt, maybe went out a little bit in college and sat on a stump and didn't shoot anything, to working in hunter ed?
Great question. I think my director at the time over in Kentucky, he felt like I had a knack for people, and he saw that with the aging staff in the hunter ed program, he needed some younger blood in there and some fresh faces. I think he even said the word eccentric. We need some eccentric people.
Okay.
You know, working with our volunteers.
So were you studying like ecology?
Oh yeah. 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 So what was funny was that my dad had come, I'd come home one day from football practice in high school. My dad was shooting a bow in the backyard, and suddenly I wanted to get interested into this bow hunting. And it was the time I was starting to think about college. So yeah, my degree's in wildlife management, studied at Eastern Kentucky University, and always wanted, you know, to hunt and get more into it. But as I started out as a professional, as a naturalist, and then starting a young family, I didn't have access to lots of places, and really didn't have anybody to get me back out there until I got this nod to get on the hunter ed team, which, thanks to my director, he not only allowed me to take a new role, but hooked me up with a mentor to take me out and get me going. So
gotcha.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. So then fast forward, you're in Iowa now, and you're starting to pick up. So what's your tenure as a upland bird hunter then? Am I hearing a year?
Cards
a season
on the table? No. I would say.
When were you born, Jamie? That's what we're asking you.
October 7th, 1979. No, it this past year probably was my fourth season.
Okay.
So I'm still new. I am hungry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I had this new pup last year. All I wanted to do was get her on a good amount of birds. And we flushed a few, and we had some poor shooting that went along with that. And so we didn't get her a chance to retrieve her first bird. So I'm still working on that here, you know, going into her second season. But it is so different when you got a dog. It puts
so much better.
And for the first time, I felt like I can mentor somebody and take some new people with me, which I was able to take some new people out. One guy hadn't been in 10 years. He did shoot the only rooster in my presence last year, but he was so excited. He beat my dog to the bird. And so my dog didn't even get to retrieve.
There is a learning curve when you go with people that don't normally go with a bird dog. So, you know, I grew up hunting off and on with guys that had dogs, guys that didn't have dogs, and then having dogs of my own. And if you hunt with people that traditionally have never hunted with a dog, and they shoot especially a pheasant because they're so tough and they run so well, you know, guys will shoot and then take off sprinting to where that bird went down, and or try to take a shot at it on the ground, you know, especially if you're in short cover like wheat stubble or something, and it's like whoa, nobody shoot at the ground, we have you know,
we got dogs. No, he is a guy that attended my church, and he was, him and his dad bird hunted for a while, and his dad had passed away a number of years before this, and he just, like myself, had a young family and couldn't get out. But man, it was a dead bird as soon as he fired the shot. It was a great shot, just dropped, and I'm like, yes, here it comes, here's Millie's first retrieve. And then I look up, and Chris is already like on the bird, he's just so excited. That was worth it for sure.
I'm glad you went with the Labrador. I like all bird dogs, but I'm a Labrador man. And recently I've done some outdoor riding for Project Upland, if you're familiar with that brand.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And, so they did an article, they gained some traction. It was like German short hair pointer is the most versatile bird dog in North America, whatever, in the world. I don't remember exactly, but I saw it on a social media post. And so I commented, I think you spelled Labrador wrong.
Ooh,
and yes. I don't know.
Rob, those are fighting words.
They were, yeah. It got spicy in the comments. Pretty cool.
Spicy in the comments.
Yeah. No, I took her out. I took her out last Monday. Dove hunting is not what it is in Kansas, up here in Iowa. It's just a different league altogether, I guess. But I'm in favor of it the way it is now, because you do get some fields that are super busy. But some buddies and I, we hunted a public land field on opener, and it was just the five of us in this 3-acre plot. We felt like we were on private land and just had good birds and everything else. But I didn't take my dog that day because I haven't had her in that setting just yet. And so she's still young, still a pup. But I did take her out the following Monday and just sat by myself with her. And she stayed good and still, just, you know, did what she wanted to. She sniffed around a little bit, but there were these till hunters that were down on the lake, and they shot a couple of times, and she heard the shots and took off out in the field. Like, where's the birds? I'm like, okay, we've got a dog that should be good if we can just keep getting her trained. But yeah, awesome. We're talking a whole lot about dogs.
Yeah. Dove season though, in Iowa, that's a new thing in Iowa. It's not historically been a season you can hunt like it has been here in Kansas where we are.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think maybe that's a great segue. At least for me, growing up and hunting Kansas, I've hunted Nebraska, I've hunted Wyoming, New Mexico, you know, kind of Colorado. Iowa, other than, you know, I could probably draw an Iowa deer tag maybe every third year as a non-resident. It's kind of a sleeper state for me, at least. So I'm curious, you know, I've driven through Iowa on my way to the Boundary Waters up in northern Minnesota, right? I've been to some business conferences and up at Lake Okoboji, I think it was, where we were at. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think Iowa was what, like 85% farm ground. You already touched on hog production.
Yeah. Yeah, there's more pigs. I think pigs outnumber people 8 to 1.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like 4 million.
That's special.
4 million people and like 22 million hogs. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
But
a lot of pigs.
I guess if you don't mind, we just talk about, okay, so yeah, there's pheasant hunting in Iowa, there's deer hunting, but what else is going on there? What do folks on the Great Plains, what should they think about when they think about Iowa DNR, Iowa hunting and fishing opportunities? Is there public land access? And
So a couple of things. I think in terms of species, you know, we've got the Missouri River, we've got the Mississippi River on each side. They offer a lot of opportunity for waterfowl hunters. There's just some of those big flood bottoms that you can get into and just see a whole lot of migrating ducks during season. So there's a lot of great opportunities. And then in between, we've got lots of rivers that, you know, traverse the state and a lot of opportunities there. And, you know, prior to heavy settlement, we still are considered part of the prairie pothole region. Nothing like the Dakotas, especially North Dakota, but we still have a lot of those, you know, native pools where these little puddle ducks can jump from pond to pond and they're great for migration. So, I think that was one thing that coming out here from Kentucky, I got to see a different side of waterfowl hunting. So I think Iowa's got great opportunities there for waterfowl hunting and goose hunting, especially in open fields. You know, obviously we touched on pheasant a little bit. Iowa's known for their deer. Our turkey program is continuing to thrive. We get more and more turkey hunters every spring that head out. And there's some places in southern Iowa that have plenty of good, strong turkey numbers. You know, I think, you know, personally, I love dove hunting. It's just so easy to do. And I think that's going to continue to pick up speed over the year. But you can't forget some of the older species to chase either. And by older, I mean the more traditional, the rabbit and a squirrel, you know, are still very, very abundant and sought after in some places. And so those are all some great species that you can get out and enjoy hunting here in the Hawkeye State.
So as a non-resident, if I decided, let's say I'm going to do like some sort of a upland trip slam, you know, I'm going to hunt Kansas, Nebraska, and I put Iowa on that list. What is that? Can I just come in and buy a tag? Is there a stamp? You know, as far as pheasants or even upland, like South Dakota, migratory. I know in South Dakota, you have to draw a duck tag as a non-resident. So what does that look like? What are the hurdles in Iowa if I decide, you know, I'm going to make the trip?
Man, this is going to sound rough coming from someone who's working for this agency, but I think one of our biggest hurdles is our regulation guide. it's cumbersome sometimes to read through and try to decipher. I've worked for the agency now for 2 or 3 years in various capacities, and I still have to sometimes phone a friend, say, hey, am I reading this right? I think just out of the gate, especially if you're upland, if you're going to do an upland, it's a non-resident license and a habitat fee. I think will get you out on most of your small game excursions. So that would include waterfowl too. You'd also need a migratory bird permit at the state level, as well as your federal stamp for those. But again, I would direct you to those regulations or that regulation guide. And then if you run into questions, here's where I think Iowa absolutely outshines a lot of other states. In the back of our hunting regs is a list of all of our conservation officers by county. And these men and women absolutely would prefer to talk to you in advance and get you set up straight to be able to allow you to buy the proper permit, tags, licenses, go through the proper procedures rather than having that conversation on the backside. And so that would be my second piece of advice is once you look through our guide, you check out our website. If you feel like you're headed in the right direction, but you need some questions clarified, look up, try to determine which county, which region you're going to be in and call an officer in one of those local counties. That's what they're there for, and they're happy to talk to folks. It's absolutely, absolutely fantastic what they provide and are willing to talk to you about.
Yeah, that's a good word. And I feel like that's like a barrier to hunting, right? Is not knowing the regulations, not knowing what to do. And I think you can venture to say, Jamie, it's not just Iowa, right? Like, I still look up Kansas regulations and fun friends too. Like, is this right? Like, refresh my memory.
We forget it during the spring and summer. It's like, it's only been a few months since I've looked at this. Why is it so different?
Yeah. And especially if you're in a role where you're in charge of like teaching the next generation or teaching a new generation, right? Like, you want to make sure you have that nailed down pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, spot on, Brittany. When we're coordinating mentor hunts and other things, you got to absolutely make sure you're getting the right information out to your people.
One thing that I've learned about Iowa, so we have a partnership with the DNR, with Outdoor Mentors, and we've been running our shooting sports outreach program there, getting their Scholastic Clay Target Program athletes out hunting. And the thing that I was so impressed by was the small game hunters. I mean, everybody loves squirrel hunting and rabbit hunting there, and raccoon hunting. It's like, really? And I say that because I grew up in Western Kansas where we don't really have trees. Like, we like, if you have a squirrel, it's like rare and people are like, don't touch it. Like, we need him to bring his friends here. So it was just really cool to hear about that type of hunting. Like you said, the traditionalist hunting of game hunting that you guys have, and people love it there.
So Jamie, in your introduction, Brittany mentioned you're working in the hunter ed, the shooter ed, that was probably a different term for that program, right? But then the fur harvesting education program. And I'm just curious, so I was a fur trapper for a number of years and did it pretty serious and was involved in some national organizations and traveled around and did clinics and things. And since the fur market is pretty well tanked, every year there's kind of, there's going to be a bright spot. It's going to be coyotes this year. I'm hearing beavers already, but not anything like it has been in the past. What do you see in that capacity as far as people signing up for that program? It seems like there's sort of this movement of trapping for your own use, maybe. Like, the idea is not to go out and put up a bunch of raccoons and send them to, NAFA doesn't exist, but send them to a fur market and try and make some money out of it. More like, I want to learn to do this as a skill, maybe send off, a few hides myself, have them tan, figure out if there's something I can do with the meat. Are you seeing that, or is that, I guess, what's the fur, there's not really industry, but the education and the program that you have there, what's that look like now?
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, Rob. You know, the fur market is certainly not what it was in the 80s. And I was talking with one of our fur bearer biologists, Vince Evelsizer. I'm having trouble with the name, but one of the oldest fur markets, going back to settlement of the United States is was struggling this year and was actually looking at closing its doors and kind of buckling up things just because the fur market is not there. And so in terms of being able to tan hides and fur, you're right. Everybody's pretty much doing it for themselves. There's no real economy that's driving fur taking and fur harvesting. But we do see a lot of folks that are interested in learning it just as a general life skill. We have in the last few years offered a couple of courses across the state just to generate some interest to see what we would get. And last year we had a class in just not far from Des Moines, and we had close to 23, 24 people that showed up. It was a free course. Originally, we had probably close to 50 that had, or 40 that had signed up. But we were fighting like 60 degree weather in late November. So people were like, yep, I'm not going to something I haven't paid for. So our attendance was down a bit, but still we had 20, 21 people there. And it was a mixture of adults and kids that wanted to learn. It was actually quite a bit of adults. I think it was mostly adults that were there and that were most interested. But in Iowa, we don't require certification to harvest. You just got to have a trapper's license, trapper's permit to be able to take fur and to trap here in the state. And so we've kind of gotten away from offering these courses. We're directing a lot of people that are seeking certification to the online platforms where they can go through trappered.com and do that. And they would need that if they decide to go out of state and trap, you know, somewhere out west or wherever. So overall, I guess we are seeing somewhat of a decline in trapping. But on a positive note, what these workshops have provided us in the last couple of years, because we had one just a few weeks ago that had 34, 35 people sign up for it, and we had another 6 or 7. So they had like 40 people at this event, and it was just a great turnout. Lots of interest, lots of enthusiasm. So we know it's out there. But going back to the positive, we've worked really well, probably in the last 12 months or so, with our Iowa Trappers Association. And, you know, those are relationships that you want to keep with partners and keep them healthy and work together to make sure that we're putting the betterment of whatever activity it is out there where we're going to produce safe and legal and responsible outdoor recreationists, whether they're taking fur, whether they're bow hunting, or whether they're just doing general hunting in whatever capacity. So yeah, certainly seeing kind of a downward trend with fur taking, but like I said, these last few months and the year have been pretty filled with hope that we may be able to continue to offer these sorts of workshops for people. We had a couple of guys come up from Kansas. They found out about them and said they don't offer them in Kansas, and they came up. So yeah, that was fun.
Maybe that's a good segue into the next topic I got written down here is hunter ed in this. I'm going to step out on a limb and say it's the post-COVID world now. I don't know if that's right or not.
I think it's safe. Iowa's been post-COVID for like 2 years.
Yeah, right. I'm with you.
So Kansas, if lightning strikes you down, we know why.
Iowa was a state that, you know, kept a lot of things open, and that's mm-hmm. what I mean by that comment, just to sure. clarify.
So, you know, I know we saw where in-person classes weren't happening, whether that was due to state regulations or people weren't comfortable. Heck, my kids went on spring break and never went back. I feel like, you know, whether it's soccer, Little League baseball, traveling, basketball, that's all back in full swing. Is there some lag time between like state agencies, at least what you're seeing in Ireland, and maybe your class load never declined, but what's a, and two, we saw, you know, record numbers of hunters and anglers, right, buying license sales were through the roof.
Yep.
Yeah. So what does it look like now? You know, we had this worldwide pandemic. We had more people buying hunting, fishing licenses than ever before. That's kind of in the rearview mirror. What do you see in the windshield now?
We see all that really in the windshield or in the back window. We here in Iowa, we had obviously that spring, we weren't offering in-person courses. In the fall, we did encourage some of our instructors that were comfortable with it to start teaching in-person classes again. Of course, we had all their proper protective equipment that they wanted. We had face shields and masks. We had sanitation protocols with our firearms. And there were a handful of instructors that decided that they were willing to do that. And we did see, you know, some of our students taking part in that. What we tried to provide during those windows was opportunities to get online, take it online. And then we were offering virtual field days. So in Iowa, if you're under 18 and you take the course online, you're required to get to a in-person field day where you hear a game laws talk, you take the exam, you have a chance to interact with a conservation officer a bit. Then they go out and they have to demonstrate how to practically handle a firearm. They don't necessarily have to do a live fire exercise, but they need to show some practical steps with handling firearms. And that was required. So kind of during that fall and even in the spring of 21, we were offering virtual options for those field days. So we would have Zoom meetings with 30, 40, 50 kids on it. We would split them out into breakout groups, and then an instructor would be on there with a group of like six or seven, and they would all have to demonstrate different things going on with firearm safety. So we were still able to deliver hunter education, I think. And I'm going to say there were probably very few states that were doing that sort of thing. And to be quite honest, when it comes to hunter education in Iowa, we really don't slow down for anyone or anything, including COVID. So, I mean, we adapt and in a lot of ways we continue to deliver. Now, since then, we're starting to see classroom numbers come up. We're starting to see a lot of kids come back, and our in-person courses have, of course, increased. And probably the biggest level increase is that we've gone from having, 50 some odd counties that offered classes last year to now, we're up near 80 counties. So we're starting to see a lot more availability across the state of people being able to get into hunter education classes. Now, in terms of license sales, I do know that we had, of course, that big spike, fishing licenses in the spring of 2020 and turkey tags, especially in the spring of 2020. And then some of our deer permits and upland permits in 2020. It was just a record year for some of those sales. That's continued to drop off a little bit. Iowa's always been able to kind of hang level. We're certainly not 1980s level with hunting license sales, but we're staying steady with a slight decrease over longer periods of time, I think would be how our R3 coordinator would sum it up if she were here. But we're kind of happy to see it behind us for sure. We're continuing to see a lot of people interested in getting into these classes and getting them set up to be safe, legal, and responsible hunters in the field.
Yeah, that's great. I love hearing the increase in number of classes available across the whole state. That's great. Yeah. A lot of states didn't see that after COVID or post-COVID. Yeah. Whatever you want to say, we've actually seen the opposite. Iowa, correct me if I'm wrong, Jamie, you guys jumped in with NRA, right? Their online hunter education. Is that
we
right?
We did not. I'm going to correct you there.
You were not. Okay. So this is okay. So you guys are still moving forward with in-person only. Do you still do any like Zoom like offerings then? Is that how I understood you?
No. So during COVID, we were offering the field days through Zoom.
Through Zoom.
Yeah. We are pretty much back to 100% in person or 100% online. So if you're over 18, you can take everything online, certify online, no need for a field day because you're considered an adult. We certainly encourage people, if they haven't been around a firearm, to go to one of our classes and do it, but it's not required by law. But if you're under 18, you got to have that in-person touch still.
Yeah, I love the in-person class. Maybe it's because I'm not a great virtual learner. I struggle with that. I don't know if it's a little touch ADD or what, but
I don't know, Brittany, if you were at any of the spring meetings. I think you were at the one here in February in Des Moines. But if you remember, there was a big study done by IGA and Wildlife Management Institute where they looked into this idea of online courses and in-person courses and what was most effective. And overall, it was a 2% difference,
right,
over a course of like 25,000 students that were surveyed over a period of a few months. And grades just did not matter all that much. And still to this day, you think about hunter education staff like myself work with our conservation officers to record hunting incidents. And we're trying to build in mechanisms now where we ask the question if the student took it online or if a student, if they were in a firearm incident or, fatality especially, we're trying to figure out what method of class they took when they took it. And right now we're not seeing it. And I think we're going to try to do better jobs of tracking that, splitting that out. But Anyway, it's so far we haven't seen any real data to convince us otherwise. I think what that study did reveal is that you got to have variety, because we have people that learn in a different way. Like my daughter can probably learn plenty of stuff online. We homeschool, she does her math online. But when it comes to Hunter Ed, I'm gonna want her to go and sit in person class like I had to do.
Yeah, I think that is probably like a great like silver lining COVID did provide all of us, is that like, we can have variety, and it's actually probably a good thing that we do have variety.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I remember listening to that study too, and they talked about like, you know, first time moms, for example, wanting to take Hunter Ed, like how challenging is it to have a baby on your hip and go to a Hunter Ed class in person, right? Like,
well, I don't know. Kentucky could probably pull it off pretty well.
We don't really think about those things until you're like, oh, no one really asked that, you know, demographic of people what they need to get Hunter Ed certified, because they might want to be a hunter at some point.
Exactly.
Well, good for Iowa. It's exciting to hear all that. I love hearing the positive remarks about Hunter Education class. You know, obviously it's something that is so important to the sport, right? Keeps ethics high, keeps people safe, keeps our wild game wild and protected. So good for you guys.
Yeah, it does.
So apart from Hunter Education and just education classes in general, I always hear about your guys' Field of Fork program there in Iowa. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that if you don't mind.
Oh, fantastic. I was visiting with one of our staff today about it. Field of Fork's a pretty neat program. And, you know, the idea had some origins in Kentucky. When I was working there, we had a biologist that was covering the Louisville area, and there was a local park that needed a controlled hunt of some kind. So he decided to put together a bow hunter ed workshop at this park to try to get interested hunters involved. But he wanted to find a new kind of hunter. And so he actually set up at the downtown farmer's market in Louisville and recruited some bow hunters that way. And so he's kind of from the get-go stressed the food aspect of deer hunting. A lot of our staff a lot of the brass at our leadership there in Kentucky caught on to it. And suddenly we had a Field of Fork program, and it was designed to teach adults who had never hunted before, who had very little hunting experience, how to deer hunt and all that it took into it. And we pulled in a whole cooking component. We brought in chefs from the University of Kentucky Culinary School. And we tried to roll out the red carpet to just provide this once in a lifetime opportunity for them to come and learn, see a deer field dress, see it butchered, talk to a butcher, you know, have a chef come and demonstrate. And again, the central focus was always food. And we had the program there a few years, and we got in cahoots with, cahoots is a good thing. We got into cahoots with the Quality Deer Management Association. And Hank Forster and some of the guys there got connected with the program. They got behind it. And then, man, they were able to just get the word out. Hank and his team did some great things to get exposure to the program. They had, it was featured in several podcasts. It was on Meat Eater podcast, I think, at one time.
The Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal, yeah. I mean, I think there was even an article like with the BBC in the United Kingdom. I mean, it just spread this idea of reaching new deer hunters through food, and Hank and his group there just absolutely blew that out of the park. You couldn't pay for that sort of coverage. But when I moved out here, one of the things that they were looking for in this position with the PF and DNR was someone that could kind of lead that locavore, as we refer to people who are interested in where the food comes from, that locavore sort of effort. And having worked with the program in Kentucky for several years, I just brought it out here. I hooked up with our archery coordinator at the time, and she and I did a pilot with staff here. It seemed to work pretty well. Then next year we took it to a state park where we did a controlled hunt. And those were one and done events. So we kind of set them up. But the big change, this is really where things change. So when we came to Iowa, we decided let's go vertical archery. So in other words, not crossbows, let's do compound bows. Let's set them up. Let's begin teaching them in July how to shoot. And then let's try to set them up to where they can successfully hunt by October 1 when archery opens up. And we did it. And it's just been incredible to walk people through this process. And so in 2020, we started working with local retailers. So archery shops, we would have our new hunters show up in an archery shop. They would purchase, they would get a bow, a loaner bow provided by our Hunter Head Association. They would also later in the year have the option to buy that bow. So whether they stuck with hunting or not, they could buy a bow and make it their own. And then we would use those funds to turn around and buy next year's equipment. And so we kind of had a revolving door with our archery equipment. In 2020, I think we had 17 or 18 participants in two different locations. Because of COVID, we actually made the move to put them in single tree stands, so they didn't have to have a mentor with them. We provided all sorts of learning opportunities up until archery opener, with the hopes that by the time archery opened, they were confident enough, comfortable enough to go sit in the stand by themselves. And it's great because now they can go hunt whenever they want to. They don't have to have a mentor. Again, they're adults, so they can drive themselves. And we've seen over the last 4 years, 80% of our participants are buying an archery tag the following season or the seasons thereafter, which is huge. And so we started out that third year, we had about 17 or 18. I think last year in 2021, we had around 26. Well, the door blew open this year. We have 41 people going through the program in five different cities. And it's gotten now to where I depend on five or six key people, and I couldn't thank them enough for their hard work, for basically serving as lead mentors or instructors. So I just coordinate with them to get them what they need. And it's great. We just had a field day this weekend over in Iowa City, and we had 11 or 12 new adults sit in a tree stand for the first time, shoot at a 3D target, and get their broadheads tuned, learn how to follow a blood trail. We talked scouting tactics. We talked a little bit about tree stand safety, of course. And then they spent Saturday afternoon going out scouting the properties they're going to get to hunt and placing a stand. So it was pretty neat to see them. And of course, they're excited. I mean, it's different. You love to see a kid get excited about something, but when you see a 48-year-old surgeon get excited because he's been able to do something new, it's really, really phenomenal. So.
Yeah, I think it's important we don't forget about that, like onset adult hunter demographic, right? And wow, what a ROI. You said 80% are buying another tag. That's incredible.
Yeah, that was pretty prelim. I mean, we're gonna take another look this year and see what that's stretched out now over 5 years. But you know, even if it's dropped to 70 or 75%, it's still great that we're seeing that many people, at least in the second year, going ahead and buying their tag. It's just showing that they feel comfortable enough to get out there and try it again.
So, and they enjoyed it enough, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And when money's tight, you got to enjoy what you're spending money on.
And you got to think, during that COVID year, you know, we had a harvest rate of like 50, 52% of our 17 hunters, like 11 of our 17 hunters harvested something, which is just unheard of to have that sort of a percentage on new first time hunters. But it was because their kids didn't have soccer in the fall, but they didn't have sports to be part of. They had more time and they could go sit in the stand more often. So we know that the best thing that we can do is give them that setup to be able to hunt whenever they can and what works for their schedule. So we're really pleased with the program, and we're going to continue to kind of find ways to adapt it and make it better, because you can take a program like that, you can get pretty comfortable with it, not change it, but then it never runs the risk of getting better. So
humility is a good thing while you're running a programming.
Absolutely.
Such as that, right?
It's just a good thing all around.
Yeah. Amen. Amen to that. What are the qualifiers to be part of the field of work program, Jamie? Is there a checklist basically?
Yep. I spent the better part of 2 weeks going through 57 applications.
Oh, wow.
I had to turn away like 16 people. And what we're typically looking for, we're able to get into our database and look to see if they have a history of purchasing a license. Not that that's a strike against them if they have it, but we're certainly wanting to keep someone that's bought three archery tags and harvested a deer already out of that program, even though it may be a confidence builder for them. We've got plenty of interest. So we really try to look for people that are brand new to hunting, have never purchased a license, and honestly, no offense here, Rob, but aren't middle-aged white men. And so as we have a whole application and things that they fill out. So we take all of that into consideration. And I think right now our female participation is at least 50% or a little bit better all across the 43. So we like to see, you know, us doing a little bit of difference there in terms of avoiding the male, pale, and stale crowd for R3.
That's really cool to hear. I mean, it's neat to see that you guys are trying to get a different demographic, just like we talked about with hunter education, right?
Yeah. And you know, it's more than just trying to check boxes with what's going on. But you know, even if someone from outside, being white and male and middle-aged, tries it and walks away, hopefully what they've experienced is the positive side of hunting and wildlife conservation, so that down the road they're going to be a supporter and they're going to know that it's a good thing. Even though they may not be in a space to be able to do it, they still support it and they still want to advocate for it. And that's probably equally as important as them becoming a lifelong hunter.
Well, Jamie, you've got a lot on your plate. I feel like we've covered all the way around the borders of Iowa and everything in between. If you've got time, let's jump into our lightning round.
And, bet. I'm here.
Kind of here.
Let's roll.
Okay. So 8 questions, kind of lighthearted, just help our listeners get to know you a little bit better, and we'll see where it goes.
Okay.
So number one, it's a perfect fall day. You've got the afternoon, you got a few hours. You get to choose. You're either going to go on a upland hunt or you're going to go on a big game whitetail deer hunt in Iowa.
The afternoon?
Or the morning, you pick. But well, you don't have time to do both.
I'm going to stick with afternoon and I'm going to go upland.
Okay. Very
good. I'm going to go upland. I'm going to go home, grab the dog, and head out.
Okay. Number two, let's stick with upland. So you're going to choose the habitat, and I understand, you know, time of day and are the birds roosting, are they feeding, all that kind of stuff plays into it. But if you were to pick your favorite type of hunting, are you going to be hunting crop stubble fields, or are you going to stick to some of those public waterway areas you were talking about, you know, some of the public river access that's got cattails and brush and thickets and things?
Ooh, if it's later in the season, I'm going to certainly go with the cattails and the brushy stuff, that thick cover for them to get into. That's probably where I would head to if it's later in the season for sure.
Okay. So number three, with that in mind, the late season, we didn't talk about angling really, but and so I don't, we'll see how you answer. You may not even be a fisherman. I don't know. You're going to go try to catch some fish in Iowa. Would you prefer late season, January, February, hard water ice fishing, or summertime fishing, bluegills, largemouth bass, that type of deal?
Great question. I'm probably going to go ice fishing because I haven't done it enough and I would love to do it more. So okay. I've had a chance to do it a time or two and it just seems super, super intriguing.
Very good.
Yep.
So number four, we're talking field to fork here. You've got a nice fat whitetail doe, the everything about the hunt was perfect. Now you've got all this protein, you get home. Are you going to choose a wild game meat sausage, like a fresh sausage? Could be a summer sausage or jerky. What's your favorite of those processed type cuts? What's your favorite?
Oh man, summer sausage, but I'm just not skilled enough to do it myself. I'll make my own jerky, but summer sausage goes to a locker or someplace like that for processing.
Okay.
But if I had to choose between the two, hands down, summer sausage.
Okay. So number five then is of that, It didn't matter which one you picked, but since you picked summer sausage, is there a favorite flavor? Are you like the jalapeno cheddar guy? Are you the, you know, the classic mustard seed summer sausage? Maybe it's like a bologna type flavor. What
you had me a bologna, bro. You had me a bologna.
B-O-L.
Do they make deer bologna? Because
oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I need to. Oh wow. You all have just blown my mind.
We know where Jamie's going after.
Walton's.com.
I grew up on bologna sandwiches, and mm-hmm. I've had maybe four since I got married.
Okay.
So if my wife's gone for the weekend, sometimes I'll like sneak off to the grocery store and get a thing of bologna and live gluttonously.
So Jamie, you need to, when you get done with the podcast, you need to go to Walton's.com and you can see all the seasonings they got and find their bologna. There'll be a garlic bologna and a classic bologna, yeah. And then you sample them all, and then we'll do this next year, and then you tell us which one's the
best. Oh man, I'd love that.
Okay, number six, what's your favorite wild game dish?
Oh,
like for your family.
Okay, it's a recipe I came across on Filton Stream's website right after I started deer hunting. You can smoke a venison backstrap for 35 minutes or so, season it with a dry rub, and it's absolutely amazing.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I'll make this little bourbon glaze to go with it, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Perfect. Loving it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Number seven. What, in your opinion, is the best wild game dish to introduce non-hunters or first-time hunters, something that's, easy, approachable, there's no intimidation there, and they're going to like it?
Yeah, you know, we did it this weekend at our field day. We had some summer sausages and some venison sticks. We had cheese, we had crackers, we had an assortment of cheeses, Gouda, pepper jack. You know, and it's kind of fun to try. If we're getting real fancy, we'll pair it with a wine or something from a local winery, and they get to try that too. So that kind of puts it in a non-intimidating sort of format. So yeah, that's probably how I'd do it.
Okay. Final question, number eight. So as we have guests on from different areas of the Great Plains, we think about kind of the iconic destination areas. So like when I think about Nebraska, I think about the Sand Hills. And then we had a guest on there and we talked about the I-80 corridor and the ice fishing along there. Put that on our listeners' radars. You know, Kansas has got the Smoky Hills and the prairie chicken seasons there. And then the Flint Hills is a region. If you haven't been there, you need to go check it out. You know, in Iowa, what area, it doesn't have to be like pinpointed down, right, but just kind of a general area of Iowa, don't burn any spots, but what destination area should our listeners be checking out?
It's all beautiful. My wife refers to it as the promised land. But I would say, you know, the Driftless area up in northeast Iowa is usually at the top of everyone's list. There's just lots of opportunities to not only hunt but hike and camp and do a variety of things outdoors. It butts up to Wisconsin. It's just a beautiful part of the state. If I was going to, in kind of my bucket trip, I'm planning this fall in state bucket trip, is to try to get northwest Iowa and try to get out along the Missouri, up near where the Dakotas kind of join in, and get up there and try to chase some birds. I mean, we've seen a 6% increase from the previous year in birds, pheasants in particular. Wow. Up there. So I want to get up northwest Iowa and do some bird hunting this fall. And on the way up, if you're coming up from south, you know, you're going to go through the Luss Hills. And those are a beautiful geographic landform that border the Missouri River there, from south of Council Bluffs all the way up to Sioux City and past. So
perfect.
Those would be my top two.
Very good.
Sounds like a great trip to me.
Yep. Come on.
You send me the dates, we'll be there.
You got it.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us and sharing a little bit about Iowa with us and all the good things the DNR is doing there. Thank you again for what you do in the hunter ed world and just education in general for kids and for adults. It does not go unappreciated.
I appreciate that. Thank you. It was great being here and being part of the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of all these, Jamie, we like to encourage people to join a conservation group out there. You know, really get involved. If you like hunting, you like fishing, you like the outdoors, join a group that has a similar mission and is contributing funding efforts. And it's a great way to cultivate fellowship with other people, hunters, anglers, or if you have that itch to learn how to hunt, right? Check out if your state has a Learn to Hunt program or a Field of Fork program. It's not too late to start. And we hope you do start.
Yeah, absolutely. Seek me out if you do.
There we go. There we go. You guys make sure to look up the Iowa DNR. Their website's great. Their Facebook and social media are great. I'm sure we can get Jamie to bug you with emails if you need to ask him a direct question. But in the meantime, thanks for joining in with us, and we hope you guys will be back soon.
All right. See you guys.
Thanks.
We'll see you later.